Hello and welcome to the Arms Control Poser Podcast. My name is William Albrecht, Director of Strategy, Technology and Arms Control at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Berlin. I will be your host as we explore the world of arms control. On each podcast, I will interview the great and the good of the arms control community about a current event related to a treaty or agreement, past, present, or only proposed. Then together, we will go, hopefully, deep enough on the history and functioning of the agreement to help you make sense of it all. And, well, that's the idea anyway. This podcast is funded by the European Union Non-Proliferation and Disarmament Consortium. Now let's get underway.
And now on with the show. Today, we have a very special episode for you. The first of three episodes on women, peace, and security, each featuring one of three different guests from the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Non-Proliferation. In this first episode, I will discuss feminist foreign policy and nuclear disarmament with Louis Reitman, a research associate at the VCDNP, as our main guest. We are also joined by two of his colleagues for extra commentary, Mara Zarka, a research associate and project manager, and Federica Dallarca, a senior research associate, both from the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Non-Proliferation. Louis, welcome to the show.
Hi, William. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm so excited that we get to have this conversation today.
I am too. Mara, hello, how are you doing?
Hello, I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me, William.
Excellent. And Federica, how are you today?
All good, thanks, William. Hope the same for you.
Yes, I am. I am very good indeed. Thank you very much. Well, let's get right into it. So this is a term, feminist foreign policy, that I've heard used a lot. And it is really, it's an interesting concept. I've heard it mentioned, but I haven't really heard very good definitions of what it all means. And, you know, from the outside, there are people who say, well, I mean, there have been plenty of female heads of state or ministers, and it doesn't really appear to alter national behavior. But that's not really what feminist foreign policy is. Louis, so can you tell me the basics? What is a feminist foreign policy and what does it mean?
Absolutely. I think that right now, because of the emergence and the spread of feminist foreign policy, which is a pretty new phenomenon, this is a very exciting and dynamic moment for gender issues more broadly. And I think what's important for all the listeners to understand, as this might be the first time that you're engaging with this topic in depth, is that this is still very much in flux. And that's why it's so exciting, because we're witnessing the shaping of what feminist foreign policy means. I mean, there's so much to say about it. I would say that for me, the biggest and most exciting thing about feminist foreign policy and the potential that it offers is the opportunity to bring that kind of critical feminist thinking that has long been confined to, you know, academia, to activism, into policymaking, into more established places. To be sure, not all feminist foreign policies are equal. I wouldn't even say that all of them are particularly feminist. But they do open the door for more progressive thinking. And specifically for the nuclear weapons space, because that's what we're also here to talk about today, including feminist perspectives means greater awareness for the harms that nuclear weapons do, especially to those groups that have long been excluded from decision-making on nuclear weapons. That's women, that's people of color, especially indigenous peoples. But it also helps us see how the nuclear status quo isn't as inevitable as traditional nuclear weapons thinking might have you believe. But you're right that before I get too in the weeds about this, I want to go back to the basics and explain, like, where's this come from?
Please.
It's really started in 2014 with Sweden, when the Swedish government was the first one to adopt an explicitly feminist foreign policy. Obviously, there had long been governments dedicated to gender issues, gender equality, women's empowerment. But this term, feminist foreign policy, was first used in that way in 2014. And the Swedish model has really become very influential for feminist foreign policies adopted by other countries. I wouldn't want to call it a sort of best in class model. We still have room for improvement, but it's certainly been very influential. So when you look at the feminist foreign policies of other countries like Germany, like Chile, like Spain, we can see some shared characteristics, and you can easily remember them as the three R's. So that's rights, that's representation, and that's resources. And I'll just quickly explain what each of those means. Rights means all feminist foreign policies really have a heavy focus on ensuring the protection of human rights for women and girls. Sometimes that extends to other minorities like queer people, not in all cases. But what you can think of there is tackling issues like sexualized violence, period poverty, overall lacking access to work, to education, to the vote, and things like that. And then there's representation. So that means including women equally in decision-making on all kinds of issues. The thought really is just that you need different perspectives, different experiences at the table if you want to make sure that your policy works for everyone and works long-term, is sustainable, right? An important part of this in all feminist foreign policies is to increase the share of women that work at foreign ministries, that work in embassies around the world, that are represented in international forums like the NPT review process, for example. But it also includes improving working conditions, addressing sexism in the workplace, making family and work life more compatible. And the last part is resources. And that just kind of means governments that sign up for a feminist foreign policy pledge that they will support those objectives with adequate resources, and they will spend money with feminist priorities in mind. So to finish that thought, these are kind of the basic building blocks, like the little Lego pieces that build a feminist foreign policy. But what feminist foreign policy means is still in flux, and there's plenty of organizations, especially from civil society, that are coming to the forefront, that are talking about, we want feminist foreign policy to mean this, and we want it to extend to that. And this also is an important part of feminist foreign policy, making foreign policy more participatory, more inclusive of civil society, responding to needs. And to me, that's a very solutions-oriented approach. So I think that's a great development.
Sure, but it's really tough because, I mean, I was following who was Ambassador Bruce Turner was really emphasizing this both in the Conference on Disarmament in Geneva, where, I mean, there were some basic rules language they were trying to change for more inclusive language, and they got a lot of pushback. But, you know, that's the diplomatic sphere. But as you all know, you know, I've been in meetings, arranging meetings where I'm not a diplomat anymore. And, you know, I don't have a team that's diplomats. And we have to consider sometimes like, okay, we can't have a young female researcher in the room. Or if you do, there's certain, you know, like, you know, if you have a very high official from a certain country, you know what I mean? Like there are countries that simply don't believe in the representation angle, you know? So Louis, how do you handle, I mean, to me, this isn't a refutation of FFP. You know, it might be an even more important point towards the need for it. But, you know, how do you handle that outside of diplomacy and the broader arms control disarmament, non-proliferation, you know, NGO, you say civil society, you know, where there are countries where representation is simply not one of the core values that's represented?
I mean, you can't force governments to staff their delegations to the NPT or other fora with, you know, a certain demographic. You can try to lay down the logic that you're pursuing as a country committed to a feminist foreign policy. You can try and highlight the benefits for everyone, for the outcome at the end of the day, for the policy outcome of having diverse perspectives represented around the table. I mean, there's so much evidence to show that including women, but not only women, in decision-making is beneficial at the end of the day. And I think if you know, certain countries are genuinely interested in finding long-lasting positive solutions to policy challenges like proliferation of nuclear weapons and nuclear armament, then they should sign up for that. But there's only so far that you can go. I mean, feminist foreign policy is not a sort of, it's not a silver bullet, right? It's just an agenda for change and that you can commit to and you can use to promote certain values and principles internationally. But it's not a mechanism to force people into what you believe.
Sure. And so what are the countries? So you've mentioned a couple, but could you go through and tell me, you know, what are the countries? You mentioned Sweden as the initiator. We've heard hints that there are countries that are not as on board. But who would you see as the core group of countries that are trying to advance this, and what countries are trying to look at advantages and how to adopt it?
So since 2014, there's been 12 states that have in some way committed themselves to a feminist foreign policy. And it's very interesting because we're seeing a lot of leadership on this from European countries, but also, especially more recently, from Latin American countries. But at the same time, we see that not all of those feminist foreign policies are equal. We can see that some states have, you know, invested more time, have thought more comprehensively about what they want their feminist foreign policies to look like. They've created strategy documents with dozens and dozens of pages. They've decided on principles, but also concrete actions on they want to implement to get to their objectives. And countries that have done this are, for example, Germany. Canada has also done that, and Spain. Others have taken a slightly more light touch approach, which doesn't mean that their what they eventually do, their actions, are any less meaningful. But they have set down their objectives in a less formal way, like ministerial statements or letters from the government, like the Netherlands or Mexico. And unfortunately, from others, we'd seen quite encouraging signs that they would develop a feminist foreign policy, but we've not really seen any progress since then. And Libya and Liberia come to mind for that. But what I want to emphasize there is that even though we can see feminist foreign policies being more of a natural choice for countries where societies are already more gender equal, where you know, those ideas might not be quite as revolutionary, it's important to underscore that feminist foreign policy can work even for countries that still have challenges to overcome, where the agenda on foreign policy looks different than the reality domestically. I think Mexico is a good example. Mexico is extremely prolific on feminist issues internationally. It was the first country in the global south to adopt a feminist foreign policy. But domestically, gender-based violence, violence against women, is still rampant. There is about 10 women killed in Mexico every day. So this isn't to say that governments should neglect shortcomings domestically while projecting sort of a feminist image abroad. But it's to say that feminist foreign policy isn't just for rich, progressive societies in the global north. It's not something you're entitled to only if your society looks a certain way. Feminist foreign policy is always an agenda for change. So even where those ideas around equity, around inclusion are less developed, feminist foreign policy can be a smart choice.
That's really interesting too. So it can be not even necessarily a reflection of the reality within the country. It can also be an aspiration for the state and how it deals with those states, even though it does still have internal issues. I think that's really interesting. And that gets me to the next question, which is, okay, so what does all this mean for nuclear weapons policy, for disarmament, for arms control? Because the nations that you've described all have at least slightly different approaches to nuclear weapons, to deterrence, to arms control, to all these issues. So it appears that feminist foreign policy doesn't necessarily have a certain mindset towards this. It can actually embrace a whole diverse set of policies. Or am I getting that wrong? What do you think of when you think of feminine foreign policy and nuclear issues?
So what is interesting is I think we're really at the cutting edge of this conversation, including with this podcast, because we haven't seen a whole lot from countries that have adopted feminist foreign policies, saying concretely how they will operationalize that in their approach to nuclear weapons. It's important to probably highlight that feminist foreign policy is more framed in the sort of women, peace, and security agenda. So FFPs talk about scenarios like migration, terrorism, civil war, and people in the nuclear weapons field know that even though all of these deal with violence and war, the WMD space is quite separated from the conventional weapons and the national defense space, if you will. So there are very few mentions of nuclear weapons in feminist foreign policies, but what there is, I think, is very interesting. So together with the German government, the VCDMP organized a side event at the NPT PrepCom. And I'm very proud that we really broke new ground with that side event. It was the first time that feminist foreign policy was discussed in the NPT context. And we had German and Chilean officials explain how FFP will influence their approach to nuclear weapons. And of course, Germany is a very interesting case to watch because it's a NATO member state that hosts US nuclear weapons on its territory. So what the German FFP strategy talks about is Germany wanting to focus more on human security rather than national security. There's an objective of funding more research into the humanitarian consequences of nuclear explosions. And there also is an ambition to focus more on victims' assistance. So for everybody who's within the nuclear field, they will know that for a country like Germany that's sort of in the middle of the field between the nuclear weapon states and the TPNW states parties, these are quite significant things to aim towards. And when we look at how gender issues have been talked about in the nuclear mainstream, in the NPT review process, it's been mostly about representation. It's been mostly about how do we get more women on NPT delegations? How do we get more women into policymaking roles? But that's quite a limited conversation. And Germany's feminist foreign policy is starting to inch just beyond that limit. It's beginning to look at not only who is making nuclear weapons policy, but also what policy is being made. And I can say a little bit more about what exactly sort of the feminist idea of nuclear weapons is.
That's a good place for a pause. We'll be back in just a minute with Louis Reitman. You're listening to William Auberk on the Arms Control Poser podcast.
I think one thing, just to step back from what Louis had already said, is that the feminist foreign policy, there's not a one size fits all. And when you talk about the impact of feminist foreign policy in the nuclear sphere, it's also important to see what country you're talking about. So Louis just gave the example of Germany that's trying to expand a feminist foreign policy, both in its foreign policy apparatus as well as in its economic apparatus. But then you have other countries like France and Canada where they're implementing a feminist foreign policy in a very limited sphere. So where you have Canada, their feminist foreign policy applies to economic assistance only. And in France's case, theirs applies to the fight against gender-based violence. So it really depends which country you're looking at and the type of feminist foreign policy they've adopted to see how it actually then expands to the WMD sphere. But one thing I just want to step back, one thing that is common among all the feminist foreign policies, despite there not being a clear blueprint or a one size fits all, is that they all tend to stress intersectionality and the human security dimension that Louis just raised in the case of Germany. So what that means is that if it were to expand to the WMD sphere, which it does in some instances, you would be changing the conversation, for example, from looking at the size of a country's arsenal to looking at more the impact the weapons have on the individuals if they were to be detonated, as well as the power of negotiations and cooperation to defuse a conflict rather than to escalate it with military means.
And so it's interesting that I think that this comes to a point, Louis, that before the conversation we were thinking about raising is it the word feminist that sometimes becomes an issue? And are we really talking about more of an inclusive, you know, human rights and values-based approach? Because it appears that there are some countries that are advancing it, you know, what you would call here in this definition of feminist foreign policy, the word feminist itself may be an issue. Is that right?
I think you're spot on with that, William. I think what Mara said about the differences between what countries claim to be feminist foreign policies are vast. And I think as the expert community, it's really our job to stay alert to that and to look more closely at where it says feminist on the tin, but that's not actually what's inside. And this is what's really exciting about feminist foreign policy, because we're seeing this definition emerging, and there obviously is a contest around what can be, what feminist foreign policy means and what can be passed off as such. I think that just because you were talking about sort of the term feminist being quite contentious, I would fully agree with you. And I find that particularly curious, to be honest. It seems often that the term feminist is more contentious than the actual policies that governments commit to under a feminist foreign policy. I've heard, you know, from women that they don't want to be singled out just because they are women. I've heard people tell me that they think emphasizing feminism is not helpful for working with certain other countries, that it's just too provocative a term. And there certainly are countries that say, you know, Finland, for instance, we do a lot for women around the world, but we just don't like the term feminist. We don't want to call it that. However, I think if we look a little bit closer at what feminism is and what it can do for nuclear weapons policy specifically, we can alleviate some of those concerns. I think the biggest misconception about feminist foreign policy is that it's just about women. It's not. It's about removing structures that hurt and disadvantage people because they are women, but also because they are not white, because they are poor, because they're queer. It's about creating more just and equitable conditions for everyone. And I think in this context, it's particularly important to highlight that feminism also supports men, because also men, you know, they have to deal with traditional gender roles, and feminism opens the possibility for men to be recognized rather than punished for feminine skills like community building or empathy or listening, which are really important skills in any policy context. And I think overall, it's more useful to think of the feminist and feminist foreign policy in the academic tradition. I think each of the listeners who has suffered through social sciences degree will know that feminism is a form of critical theory. And I like to just think about it as a tool that helps us question what's considered normal. For me, the feminist lens is a way to get a fuller picture. I think it's just a way to make things that are otherwise hidden more visible. And it's a way of drilling deeper into an issue. And I think every policymaker, every diplomat, every analyst should be interested in doing so. I think looking at things from a feminist perspective, or you might simply say from a critical perspective, everybody is better equipped to understand how the status quo came about and why it's continuing. We better understand who's interested in that and who's disadvantaged by that. And the most positive thing to me about the feminist perspective is that it also helps us see very clearly what the alternatives are. What could that more positive future look like if we reduced harm and injustice?
Well, and here we're getting, I think, towards something, you know, a really big issue in terms of an activist point of view is it's very easy for people who oppose parts of the agenda to go after the label. And we've seen this in the United States massively. It's also easy for activists themselves to completely alienate people who are completely supportive of their policies by saying, well, no, if you sign up to it, you have to sign up to all of it. Whereas, as we know, in the world itself, when we go to all the members of the UN, talking about some pretty heavy lifts in terms of fully agreeing with some of the stuff. And I do want to get onto this as part of our final question here, but I think I've been reading Federica right, that she wants to intervene. Please, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to comment on the term feminist and feminism. And I completely agree with you, William, with the fact that the term itself, it's problematic. It has a very bad reputation, unfortunately, because it's usually translated into the sole protection of women's rights and somehow translated into a limitation of opportunities, space, and rights for men, but in reality is really not the case. As Louis correctly mentioned before, the idea of feminism really is just to understand, feminism is just a tool in a way to understand whether there are differences, structural or systemic differences at the systemic level. And in a way, is an opportunity for the international community in the case of arms control and proliferation and disarmament to understand if there are inequalities that can be addressed and that can lead to the equal guaranteeing of and universal protection of human rights.
Mara, I'll let you come in just a sec. But it is, you know, we're getting to one of the core issues in foreign policy here is convincing a country that we should not exploit differences is sometimes difficult. There are countries that want unilateral advantage, that feel that that's an absolute necessity in the international system, that everyone is scrambling for more power. And so the idea of equity or sustainable options or even peace, sometimes that's just not at the core. And how countries that are adopting this approach interact with countries that have zero-sum thinking at their core, that really embrace inequality absolutely as a means to power, this is always going to be a challenge for those people who do believe in it. And I mean, I found it when I was at NATO, for instance, working on small arms light weapons, human security was always a very easy thing to sell. And saying that, you know, in order to have peace and stability in regions, you know, we really needed to look at a whole basket of issues. And it was easier to get people towards a lot of the things that you're talking about through that angle than it was if I went in and said, I think we need to adopt a feminist foreign policy. Do you know what I mean? So it's almost the label itself. It's a very useful label for understanding it from our point of view, but sometimes can be really, really difficult. And I'm sorry, I don't really have an answer there, but Mara, you wanted to come in. Go ahead.
I did want to come in. And I think just building on one of Louis' points, it's always important to remember that not every woman is a feminist and not all feminists are women. So it is supposed to be inclusive. But that being said, I think everyone on this podcast and several other scholars have posed the question that a feminist foreign policy in and of itself brings up a lot of resistance. So the question is, if we were to package it under a different name, would that make a difference? And I think one of the key ways of looking at this is also just looking at the evolution of a feminist foreign policy to begin with. So as Louis already mentioned, it has really been gaining force where you had Sweden adopting the first feminist foreign policy in 2014. And now in 2023, we have 16 states that have adopted it. But in reality, only 15, because Sweden actually abandoned their feminist foreign policy in 2022. Why did they do that? Well, they had a change in government. And the change in government led to them abandoning the feminist foreign policy with the argument saying that gender equality is a fundamental value in Sweden, but the label kind of undermines the basis of Swedish values and Swedish interests and kind of takes away from Swedish foreign policy, an obscure Swedish foreign policy. That was the government's argument when they said, we are abandoning the feminist foreign policy. And I raise this just because the Netherlands, another country that adopted a feminist foreign policy, recently had an election, and they will have new leadership coming. And it will be interesting to see how that government reacts to the Netherlands' adopted feminist foreign policy. And so I think when we talk about the label itself, it's interesting to see what's actually happening with the countries who have adopted it and when they have a change in government, and to see, will they continue kind of under their mandate that was, that they adopted under a feminist foreign policy, will they continue that work, just not label it as such, or will there be a complete shift? And it goes to question to all of you here, could we package it differently? Is it really the name that's a problem? And will we see a lot of countries, as they have a change in government, adopting the feminist foreign policies that they initially heralded?
Right. And this gets me exactly to the last big question I wanted to ask, Louis, is how do we take these policies and these ideas forward? We're talking about co-option or different views on what it means and all that. How do we keep momentum forward on this issue? How do we keep things moving in a positive direction? What can organizations do? What can governments do? Where do you see us going in the future in terms of feminist foreign policy, the ideals that you mentioned, the goals? How do we bring things forward?
I'm really glad that Mara highlighted that there can be pushback, and there can be, you know, there's not just successes in feminist foreign policy. And unfortunately, it seems that, yeah, the term feminist is often more the problem than the actual contents of that policy. But I'm very encouraged by the general direction that this is taking. There are several countries working on their own feminist foreign policies, Slovenia, Colombia. There's consortia of organizations, partnerships between governments and organizations, and that are working out what exactly feminist foreign policy should mean, trying to shape that global norm. There's international conferences that Germany, the Netherlands, Mexico are hosting. There even is a feminist foreign policy group in the UN context, sort of like we have in the NPT context. The Stockholm Initiative, Nuclear Disarmament, a cross-regional group like this, that has pledged that they will work on advancing feminist ideas in multilateral forums. So I think the momentum is definitely on the side of feminist foreign policy. But in terms of what we can do, what states can do, I think the most important part is for states that are committed to feminist foreign policy to explain, and to explain again what that means concretely for their non-proliferation and disarmament efforts. I said earlier about how nuclear weapons still feature in a very limited way in the actual policy documents. I think that states should include this explicitly in their written strategies. But it's also about bringing FFP to those major forums in the nuclear field. To the TBNW, where there already is a lot of natural overlap with the feminist agenda, but also the NPT review process, which is more mainstream, you could say. I think it's very important that this sort of speaks to the point of the problem of the label feminist. All states should understand that feminist foreign policy isn't just sort of liberal, progressive ideology. It's very results oriented. It's an agenda for change that's trying to make the world safer for more people. Because, you know, when we hear that nuclear weapons keep us safe from war or from violence, the feminist perspective would say, you know, hold on a second there. That's quite a questionable logic. Let's unpack that. But added on to that, for a lot of people who suffer the consequences of nuclear explosions, that's already patently untrue. We're already forgetting about the people who are already suffering because of the maintenance, the production, the testing of nuclear weapons, when we're excluding the problems with nuclear deterrence thinking. So I would really like to see, as sort of a concrete action, those states in the feminist foreign policy group to become active in the NPT review process and to communicate to the other states' parties, what are we trying to achieve here with this whole feminism thing? To work feminist perspectives into NPT documents. Maybe at the next PrepCom, we'll see a statement from the group, maybe a side event. I hope that somebody from them listens to this podcast. But I think on the other side, in terms of what can civil society do, what can we think tanks, us NGOs in the nuclear space do, I think for us it's important to be analytical and to see where there's a lot more feminism on the label than there actually is inside in terms of feminist thinking about nuclear weapons. Because at the end of the day, a lot of things can be serving feminist objectives. Feminist perspectives in nuclear weapons doesn't mean throwing away the whole agenda that we currently have. Nuclear risk reduction, reducing the role of nuclear weapons in national defense, serves the feminist objective of reducing violence as a political means, right? But there certainly is a lot more that countries can do to be true to their commitment to a feminist foreign policy. But we also have a constructive role to play. We can also help policymakers to figure out what exactly a feminist nuclear weapons approach looks like. We've already talked about building blocks for that on this podcast. Human security, victims assistance, including civil society in decision making. And what organizations can also do is to promote feminist scholarship on nuclear weapons, because feminist ideas have often been pushed to the fringe of the nuclear field. They've been discredited as being unrealistic or irrelevant. And it makes a big difference to what political leaders feel comfortable considering in terms of policy alternatives when there is a certain line of thinking in the big established spaces in the nuclear field versus the thinking that is happening or that finds space at the fringe of the nuclear field. So including more feminist scholarship at places like the NPT review process, the Carnegie Conference, those types of places, I think would be a fantastic step forward.
There's just two things I wanted to raise that the conversation has made me think about a little bit. One is a complaint that I have. I was working on trying to mitigate the consequences of nuclear accidents or incidents or attacks from a very early point, from the late 90s. And I was very disappointed that the Humanitarian Consequences Conference turned into a ban treaty discussion, and the idea of actually working internationally, working together on consequence management, just immediately fell by the wayside. Because I do think there's really important work to do, but now that entire issue has become, anytime you say humanitarian consequences, people say, oh, you mean TPNW. And that's unfortunate. And again, this is one way that branding and, in a way, an activist agenda ended up, for whatever reasons, the TPNW is good or bad. That doesn't really matter to me. Really, for me, I'm a consequence management person. And I just thought, there goes an opportunity to talk about that. Now, when I try to talk to people about, hey, we should put that back on the agenda, the answer is, well, no, we know what that really is now. And so that makes me sad. The other thing that we've raised here today that's really interesting is, if you're an Eastern European woman, if you're a woman from the Baltic states, and you were to say, we should get rid of nuclear weapons, they'd say, okay, yeah, Russia first. Because there's a country that does not have any progressive values whatsoever, and that has sort of a historical role in conquest, and you know what I mean? So is there a feminist point of view that could say that deterrence is actually something that helps preserve human rights, and that actually none of us want to live in a world where we're permanently relying on nuclear weapons for security, but as long as some countries rely on nuclear weapons in order to be able to threaten other countries, and they absolutely do not see, and I mean, we are talking about one country that has opposed gender language in the CD and the UN and other places. So in a way, isn't there a feminist perspective on nuclear deterrence as a way of preserving human rights and enlarging this conversation? Whereas, you know, when you say a feminist point of view is we should get rid of them, do you know what I mean? Is there a tension there, or am I reading that wrong? Federica, I see you got a comment there.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think there's a big misconception here, or it's definitely misleading to say that all feminist foreign policies are advocating for nuclear general and complete disarmament. It might be the case, but it might also not be the case. We have a lot of women that are activists for women's rights that not necessarily advocate for nuclear disarmament. Is that bad or good? I believe this is not for us to judge, but I think it's a misconception to say feminist foreign policy, oh yeah, of course, disarmament, and so deterrence is devoted to men. You know what I mean? It feeds that stereotype that obviously you're a woman, so you should be pro-peace and you should be pro-disarmament, and if you're a man, you are pro-war and you love your nukes and you want to keep them. You know, I think this is very misleading. And to that, I also want to add that, you know, we talk about women representation, the need to include women. Obviously, the aim is to have an inclusive process, right? But when we talk about women empowerment and the reason for including women, a lot of people say, well, because, you know, again, women are more prone to peace and women have genetically, they are more peaceful because of motherhood and whatnot. I think this is really something, there are no reputable studies that show or have found evidence that women's brains are, you know, essentially or biologically more prone to peace. And I think this should never be used as this assumption should never be used as an argument for including women in negotiation processes, because it's simply not true. And I think this is very important to say. We might talk about the fact that women, since a very young age, are taught to behave in a certain way, so more cooperatively, cooperatively, less assertively.
That's right, I'm sure.
And so that there are studies that have demonstrated that this cooperative spirit has led to the adoption of peace agreements in the past. I think there's a study from an institute in Geneva. I think it's the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies in Geneva that has analyzed over 80 agreements, peace agreements, and those negotiated by balanced delegation, gender balanced delegations, were those agreements that resulted in more peace, durable peace processes. So, I mean, there is an element here, but just to close the conversation or my point, we really should not use the argument that, oh, because you're a woman, you're pro-peace and you're pro-disarmament, and because you're a man, you're not. I think this is an important clarification that needs to be done and made.
Okay, Mara, any thoughts?
Yeah, well, just on that point, I think it's important to keep in mind that a feminist foreign policy, as we've already said, there's not a clear definition of what this is, and so states are kind of shaping it the way they want. But one thing that is clear is the intersectionality and kind of the human security dimension. So if you want to expand that to deterrence, it will depend on different camps of feminism, what they believe, whether deterrence is a feminist principle or not. But Louis mentioned it in some of his earlier remarks, the idea of having nuclear risk reduction talks, that can certainly fall within a feminist foreign policy. And so yeah. I think it very much depends on what type of feminism you prescribe to, but just the idea of intersectionality, broadening what it means, what security means, especially in the WMD sphere, is the direction that feminist foreign policy is trying to push the conversation and to really get out of the status quo way of thinking about our security related to WMD and opening it up to other more creative possibilities.
And Louis, you know, this is a EU NPDC podcast. Are any final recommendations you'd have for our EU member state listeners?
I would like to come back to that question, but I did want to respond to your, because I think this is quite an important point
okay.
About
sure.
the tension between feminist foreign policy and deterrence, and the question, well, are the Russians and the Chinese going to go, oh no, feminist foreign policy, now you've got us, now we're going to disarm, and yeah.
Right.
I think part of the problem here is that there's a reflex from the people who subscribe to the status quo, traditionalists, people who subscribe to nuclear deterrence thinking, to raise the question, oh, but how can you advocate for this? This doesn't even fix all of our problems. Well, neither does nuclear deterrence, to be honest. I mean, that paradigm hasn't gotten us to a place where the world is safer from nuclear weapons, according to the assessments of most observers, like the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, for example. We are facing a bigger nuclear risk than at almost any point in our past. So there's a problematic reflex of going, well, this idea doesn't solve all of our problems, so it's not even better than what we currently have. And I think this is very sort of black and white thinking that doesn't consider that there's a lot of stuff in between, let's just keep things as they are, and this will get us to complete nuclear disarmament globally, that we can achieve if we adopt a feminist perspective. For example, if we look at the UK's expansion of the nuclear arsenal that was enabled by the 2021 Integrated Review, there's been a lot of criticism around whether that expansion is necessary strategically, whether that actually helps to maintain minimum credible deterrence. There's been a lot of criticism of the decision to reduce transparency around the nuclear arsenal, saying that that contributes to nuclear risk. It's actually not a very good idea. And the strategic advantages of not disclosing how big or how capable your nuclear arsenal is are questionable. And at the same time, we have in the United Kingdom right now a spiraling cost of living crisis, a nuclear arsenal modernization program that is spiraling out of control in terms of costs. And I think the feminist perspective would, for example, say, do we really need to spend all that money to have more nuclear warheads when we should really be focusing on what can make this society safer and more prosperous? Is that really nuclear weapons, or do we have other priorities that we should be putting first? Why are we prioritizing spending on what we call hard security rather than soft security, the stuff that actually, would save lives today and tomorrow, better healthcare, better access to critical services, housing, social welfare, these types of things. So I think that this is a way in which the feminist perspective can contribute to us finding those actionable steps right now that can improve people's well-being and safety, rather than focusing on nuclear armament as a solution to our security problems. But I also wanted to talk about Federica's point about women not being inherently peaceful and feminist foreign policy not necessarily being about pacifism. Interestingly, the German strategy document says that very explicitly. It says that feminist foreign policy is not pacifist. And this is clearly an attempt by the different countries. We've heard the example of France mentioned, trying to reconcile feminist commitments with, what those countries would perceive as their security requirements. But we have to be honest that there is a risk of co-optation of the feminist agenda. We have to be honest that not all efforts that center women are feminist or support nuclear risk reduction or disarmament. I mean, there are a lot of sort of gender equality and women's empowerment and sort of girl boss initiatives by companies like Raytheon, like Lockheed Martin, companies that actually produce nuclear weapons, or by the government agencies that are involved in producing and maintaining nuclear weapons. And sometimes those practices are problematic because they help to future-proof the nuclear weapons enterprise. They help to uphold traditional weapons thinking because they're not really about changing the way that we see nuclear weapons. They're not really about policy change. They're more about dressing up the existing power structures to fit our modern time expectations about equality and progressiveness. One good example of this that gets mentioned in this criticism is that look at the United States government. Look at how many very senior positions are now held by women, but look at the same time at the relatively stable course of U.S. nuclear weapons policy. So we just have to be honest that that kind of corporate feminism that essentially aims at having an equal share of men and women carry out the same set of policies is not about policy innovation and policy change.
And I think here we've come to a good closure point. I think we've come to a good understanding. There are some core, ultimately people are going to either try to advocate for change in policy, are trying to disrupt the order, others are trying to maintain order, and people will see FFP either as something that helps advance interests and advance status quo or advance disruption. That's a really interesting perspective. But look, I think I've learned a lot today. I want to thank you all for being here. Louis, thank you for guiding us through a very interesting and very nuanced discussion.
Thanks so much, William. This is great.
Thank you, Federico. Thank you, Mara.
Thank you, William.
That'll do for part one. We'll come back in just a minute for part two. All right, welcome back to part two of the Arms Control Poser podcast. So this is the part where I ask Louis Reitman, Research Associate at the Vienna Center for Nonproliferation and Disarmament, how did you get here? How did your career take you to this point? And let me start the question by asking, was there a first point in your life where you were aware of arms control, nonproliferation, nuclear weapons, concepts, thoughts? Was this something you were following from childhood, or is it something that came much
later? Can you imagine if that was like something that featured so heavily in my childhood? Wouldn't that be depressing? If I was like an arms control geek when I was five? No.
You say that, but about half your listeners just went, huh, really?
No, honestly not. My childhood was mostly... I was so into like dinosaurs and matchbox cars and... Nuclear
so you could have been into
really
dinosaurs because you were afraid nuclear winter was going to bring dinosaurs back because we're all going to be
extinct. I wasn't really smart enough to make that connection, I don't think.
So when did this all happen? When did this, so where are you from, first of all?
I grew up in a tiny town in eastern Germany called Hettstedt. I was born and raised there. And then... that's where I lived until I was 18 years old, and I went to university in Vienna, in Austria. It's funny that I'm back again. But it was actually around that time that I first became interested in nuclear weapons issues. This sounds like a really corny story that some high-flying political candidate would include in their autobiography, but... I was a very impressionable political science student in Vienna, and I was listening to a speech by the then UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, and I think it was something like the 20th anniversary of the CTBT opening for signature, and the SG was talking about how he was counting on the next generation to finish the job of eliminating nuclear tests. And I just thought, damn right, we're going to do that. We're really going to tackle that I just felt really emboldened by his message. It was maybe the first time that somebody spoke to me directly as a young person saying, I want you to do this. I need your help doing this. So it gave me that kind of sense of urgency that I think a lot of people have when they enter the nuclear field. And once you realize the scale of the threat of nuclear weapons, like how there's, you know, like what, like 12 or 13,000 nuclear warheads in the world that could end humanity several times over at any point, it's kind of difficult to stop caring about
it. I certainly find that. I agree. I mean, actually, for me, it was. I actually grew up near New York City and Philadelphia and a bunch of military bases. And I remember asking my father if there was nuclear war, what would happen? And he said, oh, you don't have to worry. We die first. So that was...
pretty much.
So that was kind of bleak. So university in Vienna, and then where did you go?
Well, I did quite a bit of stuff related to nuclear. I immediately after that speech by Ban Ki-moon, I joined the CTPTO youth group.
So while you're still a student?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I did an internship at the U.S. mission in Vienna. I wrote my undergrad thesis on North Korea. And that kind of continued.
What on North Korea? What did you write?
I was just kind of baffled by how this tiny, isolated, impoverished country could develop nuclear weapons and threaten nuclear war against like the world's remaining superpower. You know, like how was that possible that they achieved this? And to me, I thought there must have been something that went terribly wrong in what the United States was trying to do. I mean, how did they mess this up, basically? So I was looking at denuclearization diplomacy through from the Clinton years all the way to the Trump administration. And I was trying to find sort of what could have gone better. How could they
improve? If you like, Jeffrey Lewis and I talked about this extensively in one of the podcasts, but I think that's a different conversation you and I should have at some point. North Korea, what went wrong?
Definitely. I can tell you that I didn't find the answer. Okay. I didn't manage to solve the whole North Korea thing.
I'm sad about that, but I'm also glad because we couldn't figure it out either.
Yeah, I think that's a sad trend.
So after university, so while you were at university, intern at the U.S. mission, paper on North Korea, but you still have to pay the bills. So what did you think of next?
Yeah, basically, after I graduated from my master's at LSE in 2019, I spent some time in the city.
Did you go directly from university? So you went directly from Vienna to London to LSE?
No, I mean, I did some, I did two semesters abroad, one in Nottingham, one in Chicago.
Okay.
Chicago was an interesting place. I did, I volunteered with the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and I met, Kenneth Benedict, the former editor-in-chief. So that was a great time. It was very fascinating. But then after that, I went to London to do my master's and, I always kept connected to nuclear issues, even when I was exploring different career options, different interests.
Then you graduate with your master's degree, and what next?
I did something completely uncharacteristic. I had never been interested in working in the private sector at all, but then I was surrounded by all these finance and management students at LSE, and they made me feel like, you know, maybe I was missing out on something. So I worked for a big corporation in sort of financial and economic crime investigations. It was possibly exactly what you're thinking about, fancy office suits, after work drinks at expensive bars and that kind of thing. And it was a great job. It was very interesting. But it just wasn't for me. I think the private sector experience wasn't for me.
And so what did you do? Were you at that point? Were you actively looking for jobs? Were there just people in your life who were trying to get you out of there and get you into something else? How did you end up at VCDMP?
Well, yeah, I was at some point desperate to leave that job. And then sort of like, I don't know, I mean, calling it destiny is probably a bit too far-fetched, but I took a bit of a leap of faith leaving that job for like my dream internship, basically. Oh. But it was not well paid, of course. It was an internship and it had like zero job security. But I did a Blue Book traineeship with European External Action Service in Brussels, which is like the EU's diplomatic service for the listeners. And I got to work with the EU Special Envoy for Disarmament and Non-Proliferation, Marjolein van Dalen, and with the team, which was amazing. It was fantastic.
We love Marjolein.
Of course, she's a force to be reckoned with, the EU's biggest asset. and then via a quick stint in export controls at Imperial College in London, I came to the VCDMP.
Oh, that's great. Well, okay, so one last question then. If you could go back at any point during your life and give yourself advice, what point in your life would it be and what advice would that be?
That's a really good question. I think I would tell myself probably at my sort of during my master's studies, I would try to tell myself, don't worry about specializing too early. Because my worry was always this whole nuclear thing, like, is that really sustainable? Is that really something like, where are you going to work? Shouldn't I be doing something else? Should I not box myself in too much, perhaps? And I was trying to explore different things. But I see it now with people who enter the field very young, who are very determined and who aren't sort of afraid of just following that passion. And I think that's what I should have done a little bit more. So for anybody out there who's like early career in the nuclear field, don't worry about picking the thing that you're really interested in early on and just going for it. Because that passion and that interest will translate for other people. They will see that and they will want you to work for them. So that would be my advice.
I think that's great advice. And that's where we'll leave it for today. Thank you so much, Louis, for being on today. Thanks for sharing your time, your passion, and your knowledge. I really appreciated having you on, and I hope to have you on again soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, William. This was a great conversation.
Well, that wraps it up for this podcast. My thanks once again to Louis Reitman for just an incredible conversation. Thanks, as always, to the European Union Non-Proliferation Disarmament Consortium for funding the podcast. Thank you to Brian Freeman for the excellent music that he supplies to every one of our podcasts. My name is William Alberg. This has been The Arms Control Poser. See you next time.
I repeat again.